For years, I've gathered from friends and family the essential bits of wisdom that one must know to make it in Atlanta. Imagine this Midwesterner's joy when I saw the following book cover leap out at me at the library. Suck in your stomach and put some color on. What Southern mamas tell their daughters that the rest of y'all should know too. Eureka. It has been, if not my most fruitful source of introduction to life in Atlanta, certainly my most entertaining. There's Debbie Wilson's warning from her mother. Always remember, Mom and God are watching you. Or the rather strange, if you let anyone look at me after I'm dead, I will haunt you for the rest of my life. My personal favorite is from Betty Haley of Mirrouge, Louisiana. Mama always said, nice girls don't do that. She never said what that was. When you live in a culture your whole life, you learn the unspoken rules, whether you choose to follow them or not. Which is why it's not surprising that when the slaves in this morning's parable received money from the nobleman, they knew exactly what they should be doing with the coins he dropped into their open palms. As Jesus tells us, the first two slaves get to work right away, and when the master returns, they have turned a profit for the boss. The money belonged to him, after all, although the gain was their responsibility. The comfortable cadence of the story ends here. The third slave had something else in mind for the master's arrival. Defiant, he returns the pound entrusted to him, crumpled up in a linen napkin, and speaks the words his people both long and fear to hear him say, Lord, here is your pound. I wrapped it up in a piece of cloth, for I was afraid of you, because you are a harsh man. You take what you did not deposit. You reap what you did not sow. Consider the scene. I imagine his witnesses holding their breath and staring down at their bare feet. What consequences await the whistleblower and those connected to him? Jesus tells us that we're dealing with a master who has traveled to distant lands to get royal power for himself. His authority was absolute. When at long last his power is compromised, he turns to violence. The third slave has violated rules no one questions. Life in the ancient world was organized into three basic spheres: the household, the city, and the kingdom. The power in the kingdom itself was held by men like this master. Each kingdom, like a quilt, was patched together by the nobleman's relationships and his investments, which he curried by traveling abroad and securing royal power. For the accumulation of wealth to continue in his absence, he entrusted portions of it to household slaves who managed his investments for him. For the slaves, the goal is twofold. Make enough money to secure and double the master's investments, and slowly and carefully stash away what you can for yourself. This scheme was no secret to the master. As William Herzog notes, in fact, The master stands to gain a great deal by encouraging the process. Not only do the retainers do his dirty work, exploiting others for profit, but they siphon off anger that would otherwise be directed at him and his class. There's plenty to be concerned with in this parable, whose effect is as potent today in Atlanta as it was in first century Galilee. Which is why it may surprise you to know that most of the interpreters I've read have come to tidy moralistic consensus about this story. When I looked on the internet to find other preachers' beliefs about this parable, this is a prime example of what I found. God has endowed every one of us with talents. He wants us to develop our talents. Use properly what God has given you. Work on it, and you will receive more. And a lazy person will lose even what he now has. In dozens of interpretations of this story I encountered, the nobleman represents God. This is deeply problematic, to say the least. God is not the divine mortgage broker. The question this parable raises is not, what do we do with our God-given talents? The question it raises is this: whom do we choose to follow? Will we follow the one who manipulates and controls us? Or do we have the audacity, like the third slave, to follow God's insistent call toward justice? When I was a child in language arts class, I remember filling out worksheets about the stories I read. Who was the author? What happened in the story? Who was the main character? Profound questions. The answers in the back of the textbook always mystified me. The main character, according to the textbook, was the one who got to speak the most and came out on top, rather than the one whose brief action marks the very moment in which the world as we know it turns. The one to watch in Jesus' parable is not the aristocrat who calls the shots, but the slave who risks everything, and in so doing, ushers in a new reality for master, slave, and those who listen in. Speaking of textbooks, maybe you've heard of the battle waging in Texas schools. Of late, debate centers on which historical material to include in the educational curriculum. As one of the largest purchasers of textbooks in the country, what Texas ultimately decides will influence what our children read around the nation. One member of the Texas State Curriculum Board successfully moved recently to eliminate Oscar Romero, one of the most influential voices against oppression in world history, from the educational standards. Why? She didn't know who he was. Perhaps that is because the nobleman nearly always receives center stage access to our historical memory. Four decades ago, in an ocean away, thousands and thousands of people were being tortured, quite literally, by the same reality as the slaves Jesus tells us about. Oscar Romero, a Catholic priest, was just named Archbishop of El Salvador. in the midst of a terrible war against the country's poorest. In El Salvador, like in most places in the world, the majority of people walked a tightrope, save enough to literally feed and clothe your family, and if you're lucky, avoid the scrutiny of those with weapons and power. Archbishop Romero had grown up among those people. But as those closest to him tell, over the years, he had lost touch with their experience. The people feared that Romero's election would solidify the church's alignment with the government forces, whose theology and practice threatened the people's lives. In El Salvador, what you believed, or perhaps more accurately, who you believed in, was a matter of life and death. When the people sang about God in their hymns, they said, "You are the God of the poor, the simple human God, the God who sweats in the street, the God of leather-skinned face. That is why I speak to you the way my people speak, because you are the laboring God. You are the working Christ. You walk hand in hand with my people. You struggle in the field and city. You stand in line out in the projects to receive your day's wages. I have seen you," they sing, "in the fish shop, bartering what you caught. I have seen you at the gas station, checking tires of a truck. You, worker Christ, are not ashamed of this humble work." In the echo of these songs, two peasants, a young boy and an old man, and a priest, were murdered by a government aligned with Catholic aristocracy. Romero showed up at the funeral that night, and when he saw the look of grief and resolve on the people's faces, his true conversion began. As his friend and priest John Sobrino writes, "Romero's conversion, the definitive factor, the one that kept him faithful to God's will to the end, was his people, a people of the poor. And the fact is, as I have already remarked, that in El Salvador, as in so many other places in Latin America, before the church had made an option for the poor had made an option for the church. They had found no one else to defend them, not in the government, not in the armed forces, not in the political parties, and not in private enterprise. This Christ Romero encountered that night had an option for those who felt they had no options. This was a God who stood alongside the people and through his own identification with their suffering brought liberation. These people heard the words of the psalmist, "For you did not despise or abhor the affliction of the afflicted. You did not hide your face from me, but you heard me when I cried to you." These people took those words as literal promise. They had had enough bad experiences in life to know that only the good Lord's power can save them. And so the good Lord abided with them even as many men and women and children disappeared, until even one day Archbishop Romero himself was killed as he led the people in mass. The words he spoke earlier that week prepared them for the journey to come. "If they ever take our radio," he said, "suspend our newspaper, silence us, put to death all of us priests, bishop included, and you are left alone, a people without priests, then each of you will have to be God's microphone. Each of you will have to be a messenger, a prophet. The church will always exist as long as even one of us is left alive." Perhaps these words resounded in the heart of the slave who cried foul. When the presence of a new possibility is made known to you, finally, those of heart and courage become partners with God. Have you heard this startling prayer? "God, send out your Spirit upon us. Because if you are with us, nothing else matters. And if you are not with us, nothing else matters." In this Lenten season, this is our prayer. This is our hope. Friends, this is the promise. Jesus' journey to the cross is not a tragic journey toward death. Those who choose to follow become partners in a powerful movement toward life. In the words of one great theologian, "The gospel is a light burden, in the sense that the more one bears it, the more one is borne by it." As always, the best parables leave us with as many questions as answers. What is hope? What is prophecy? What is salvation? And when we turn to ask him, he has headed up in front of us to Jerusalem. And soon we will know what salvation means. Soon we will know. Adelante, Señor. Onward, good and righteous Lord.